Hello and welcome to Answer Me This. Thank you for listening.
If you've just heard some ads, please know we do not control which commercials you get to hear.
But now they're done, here is an episode of Answer Me This. Hello and welcome to Answer Me This. Thank you for listening.
If you've just heard some ads, please know we do not control which commercials you get to hear.
But now they're done, here is an episode of Answer Me This.
When Mad Men ends, can I have all the props?
Answer me this, answer me this.
What was Mickey Mouse on when he saw the dancing mops?
Answer me this, answer me this. Helen and Ollie, answer me this.
Election fever is gripping the nation. All around Britain, people are practicing posting a ballot paper into a box. What a thrill. And
so exciting, isn't it? Thinking about which of three dispiriting boxes you might put a pencil in.
Here's an election-related problem from David from Scotland, who says, whilst walking up the road home from work this evening, I looked up at my flat to see a certain...
Alex Salmon threatening us to vote for him.
I looked up at my flat to see a certain political party's poster in my own living room window.
Okay.
Not being a supporter of this party, I am not keen for their poster to be in my window. When my flatmate, the putter-upper of the poster, returned, I explained that I didn't feel right with a poster for a party I don't align with in our window.
Mm.
I asked if he could put it up in his own bedroom window and show his support from there. He says, I'm being unreasonable by not allowing it to go up. He suggested polling our third flatmate, little pre-election practice, and going with his decision. However, even if they both support this party, I don't feel comfortable with the poster in our living room.
This feels like an episode of Coupling. This doesn't feel like the kind of thing that would actually happen in a real person's house.
So, Ollie, answer me this. Am I being unreasonable by not allowing the poster in our living room, or am I in the right? Vote now!
That is a fascinating dilemma, actually.
It is.
Because my instinct is, David, no, you're absolutely in the right.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But I then thought about it, and I thought, well, if you were in a house share of, say, 10 people...
Mm.
And the other nine all voted for that party, then you'd say, well, nine out of the ten, nine-tenths of us...
That's democracy.
That's democracy. Support this party, so we'll put their poster in the sitting room.
Well, in some systems, one-third is still the ruling thing.
Well, exactly. Your flatmate does have a point, that if the other flatmate supports that party...
That's a straightforward majority.
To an extent, they'd be within their rights, but that's not considering your feelings.
No, so David's flatmate needs to form a coalition, a living room coalition, to get this poster. But still, what is wrong with the flatmate not wanting to display it in his bedroom? Surely, to the passerby, that window wouldn't mean something different to them
from the outside? Well, it depends. I'm guessing that the living room window is more prominent.
Mm.
Also, I mean, it's interesting. I made a joke about Alex Salmon earlier. I mean, David doesn't say which party it is that he's referring to. But actually, you know, across the referendum, the SNP were being accused of being involved in, you know, intimidation, some people were saying.
Say like,
If you're not a supporter of the SNP, you're less likely to put up a big poster because they're so popular in Scotland at the moment.
Mm.
So I can imagine that if you come home to your house and you feel uneasy about the Scottish National Party, seeing a big poster of the SNP, especially if you're a Labour supporter, must feel quite difficult.
Maybe you could put up posters of every available candidate.
The truth is, most of us feel about the parties that we're going to vote for that they're the least worst option. Most of us don't feel that passionate about the posters, and that's the problem, isn't it? It's only the people who feel really gutturally excited by a party that put a poster up for it.
You know what would win the election for any of these people? If, say, Nick Clegg got Olivia Colman to make house calls, then everyone would be like, yeah, whatever you say, Olivia Colman.
If Olivia Colman goes around everyone's house in a marginal seat in the country.
Just with her kind face, I think people would go for whatever she wanted. She holds that power.
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
With her face.
Where I am, we have an almost unmovable Conservative majority.
That's what happens when you move out of city.
When you move to the Greenbelt, yeah. And when you drive to where I live, you go down an A road, and the only advertising for any political party that there is anywhere in the whole constituency that I've seen, including in the major parts of the town, is a series of, I wouldn't call them billboards because they're just like tiny little posters on sticks. You know the
ones
I mean?
Yes.
Like they're almost like banners that you'd hold in a protest. They're that size.
Yeah. Or like estate agents' boards.
Exactly. And the Tory candidate, Oliver Dowden, he's bought what appears to be 150 of these, and he's just lined either side of the road with these banners. So what do the banners say? Nothing, just his name and his face.
That's all he needs.
Name and face, and then Conservative. And I just thought, he actually had an opportunity there when I was driving past to pitch me a policy.
Like a kind of Burma Shave type thing. What do you think about immigration?
None of that. Just his face and his name. It's almost as if he's just basically, do you like white men? Do you like fields?
That's all you need to win in the Green Belt.
It is probably quite a fair pitch, actually, for Hartsmere, yeah.
Maybe he's not even standing. He's just like, I'm Oliver and I'm a Conservative.
Oh, wow, that'd be amazing. If it wasn't a pre-election tactic, you know, vote for me because you like these fields and you like my face. But instead, it was just the beginning of a reign of terror, whereby if he does become MP once again, he'll start putting pictures of his face over every field.
And every window.
Indeed.
Because you'll open your curtains and there's Oliver Dowden. No sunshine for you, exactly. Just Dowden face.
That is, but that is equally what he's promising with just his name and a face and a poster.
Yeah.
I don't know anything more than that.
Let's reel back and help David with this predicament. One option could be to dirty your window. Throw some mud or an egg at it. Yes, throw an egg at your own window. No, throw an egg at your own window from outside so your flatmate thinks that somebody has taken exception to his poster.
Oh, I see. I thought you meant whilst you're in the kitchen, just throw an egg at the poster from inside.
These things do happen, but that will only serve to glue it further to your window because egg is a very strong glue. You could cause house warfare, David, by taking the poster down or turning it upside down, or not taking it down in a deliberate looking way, but making it look like the blue tack has failed and it has fallen on the floor behind the sofa where it is hard to pick up again.
I disagree. I think canvassing or advertising for a candidate is a much stronger political statement than voting for them in the privacy of the polling booth. I think he has every right to say, I don't want to be an advert for this person. Just take it down.
Or you, if it is just their name and a face a la Oliver Dowden, you could just put an A4 piece of paper next to it saying, is a cunt.
Yes.
Then you've covered both sentiments, haven't you?
Yeah, subversion. Yeah.
And if they don't like it, and be like, well, we'll both take our posters down then. Here's a question from Sarah, who says, I'm always stuck in a manky restroom. What a life.
If you can call it a life.
It's what's the stage between...
Purgatory.
Yeah, it's purgatory, isn't it?
Poogatory.
It's our first ever email from Poogatory.
Well, we don't know. A lot of people don't specify.
I'm always stuck in a manky restroom without a hook for my bag.
Okay, always when I'm in a restroom... So not I'm always in a restroom, but always when I am in a restroom, hooks are lacking.
On occasion when I'm in a restroom.
Yes.
Hooks are lacking, and by bag, she's talking about handbag, not colostomy bag.
Well, we don't know.
Helen, ask me this. What is more disgusting, putting my bag down on the floor or putting it on the diaper changing table?
I think the floor is more disgusting because I think it's easier to wipe down a changing table.
I also think that because of its primary use... if you're the person who cleans that toilet, you're going to take particular care to use wipes
that
surface.
It's at eye level, so you think, better give it a cursory clean. Whereas the floor, I mean, you're tracking waste around as well as the waste falling there on its own accord.
That is true.
Is a toilet floor inherently more dirty than the floor outside it?
Well, this is what I was thinking. I was thinking, actually, being honest, there are probably more germs on a train carriage floor than there are on a toilet floor. Because the toilet, so long as it's a reasonably, I mean, she's saying manky restroom, but as long as it's a reasonably reputable business, someone will have to go and clean that toilet at least twice a day. That doesn't happen on a train carriage.
Check the forms on the wall.
Yeah.
But you do have probably a higher concentration of various excretions on the toilet floor, and those less concentrated the further away people are walking from the toilet place.
Yes.
I take your point, but people don't walk into toilets to literally piss and shit on the floor.
Martin, some toilets I've been in, you do think, what went through this person's mind?
I mean, she gave us the straightforward choice here between the changing table for the baby or the floor.
Changing table, unequivocally, I would say.
But I would still say, given a third option, I would say the cistern is actually probably cleaner than either.
Not always a cistern available, though.
Yeah. True enough. But if one is available, wouldn't you say cleaner? Because you can also go over it with a bit of a paper towel. No one craps on there. It's very difficult for crap to end up on there.
People could easily piss on there. By people, I mean men could easily piss on there.
Yeah, okay. Technically, they easily could, but
not by accident.
You wouldn't aim upwards. Yeah. You can piss on the floor by accident when you're aiming downwards.
Depending on the toilet as well, you might get a thin powdering of cocaine on the bottom of your bag.
Maybe it has a certain antiseptic quality.
Go to a camping shop and buy a portable hook.
There's a dead cert Dragon's Den product in this, isn't there?
I'm sure it exists already.
The portable toilet purse hook.
You know what would be better if you were Dragon's Denning anything? Hover bag. I can't wait for someone to invent hover bags, that mainly for suitcases. Yeah. Wouldn't that be such a help?
That would
when
be amazing
traveling?
In the airport. Yeah, it would.
Trunky's good, but hover bag is better.
Hover bag is better, yeah.
Someone, please.
Hi, I'm Molly and Martin the Salmon. It's Becky in Bedfordshire. My cousin Cass wants to know, how come when you spill red wine, white wine gets thinner?
It doesn't.
What?
It's just popular wisdom, but it doesn't really. It just dilutes a red wine stain into a pink wine stain that is further spread over your carpet.
Well, it surely wouldn't be folk wisdom if the efficacy of it wasn't at least increased from using soap.
No, they have done tests and they've found that white wine was less effective than using nothing. So if you just put your clothes through the wash with not even any soap, that would work better than putting white wine on your red wine stained clothes.
Are the tannins not more soluble in alcohol?
Oh, yeah, okay. It's really stupid how on the internet people try and scientifically reason this, but they just say the white wine neutralises the red wine without actually going into what that means. But I think it is just the things that stain are the tannins in the red wine. Alcohol does help those not stain so much, but white wine is quite an inefficient alcohol with which to do this because it's got a lot of sticky sugar in it. It has colour itself. So if you want to use alcohol for that, gin or vodka would work a lot better. Yeah.
Okay.
But then you're still like chucking expensive stuff all over a stain. What you want to do is absorb as much of the stain as possible and then like douse it with soap or a special wine cleaner thing and put it in the wash straight away. The reason why this is such a pervasive cleaning myth, it must be because when you have red wine, often white wine is near at a dinner party, say, and so it's either chuck white wine on it or chuck salt on it, which also doesn't work very well. But it does at least absorb some of it, but it's quite an expensive way to absorb wine.
But do you know why this is funny is you've done the Googling and clicked on the third link. Most people, when they're Googling, how do I get rid of red wine stain? It's one of the most frantic Googles ever.
I read a whole study from University of California in Davis, where an academic actually tried lots of different things on lots of different materials.
2 o'clock in the morning, clearing up from a house party. Yeah. You haven't got sex. I think along with, is it okay to have sex with the baby in the room? That's going to be one of the most frantic Googles that people do, because they just want the reassurance.
If you've got a question, email your question to answer me this podcast at googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast at googlemail.com.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts. Here's a question from Dave, who says, I have a hankering. That's a word you don't hear too often, isn't it?
No, you don't.
Hankering.
Bring back hankering. It's the yearning that's fun.
It is. It is. It's kind of sexy yearning, isn't it?
I don't think it's sexy so much as playful.
Yeah, no, I don't mean like erotic, like full thrust erotic.
But more like, oh, chase me.
Yeah, exactly. Innuendo. It's like hanky-panky. Yeah. Hanky-panky plus yearning.
You probably think handkerchief is a sexy word as well.
I have a hankering to eat some sort of edible food stuff.
As opposed to some inedible food stuff.
Yeah, tautology, mate.
Yeah, your ambitions are achievable thus far, Dave.
Yeah.
that is older than I am.
Okay, how old are you? If you're one, that's not hard.
I am 33.
Should be something in my mum's freezer from the early 80s.
I'm pretty sure my mum's got the odd packet of Smash that's at least 20 years old, but I don't know, 33.
A Twinkie, surely.
So, Helen, answer me this. What is the cheapest way for me to achieve my goal, ideally without too much faffing about?
Well, I think if you set yourself this kind of goal, then faffing about is part of the fun.
Yeah, you've already emailed a podcast about it. I think the faff has already commenced.
I mean, otherwise you could just get in touch with the suppliers of extremely artificial foodstuffs and ask them to turn something over to you.
So it has to be food and not drink. So you couldn't have a bottle of wine, because that'd be pretty easy.
A bottle of wine's very easy.
Whiskey, brandy.
I wonder how cheap a 33-year-old bottle of wine... If you bought like a Jacob's Creek in 1982 or 3, whenever he was born... Would that just be worth much now? Would it cost much now to buy? Because like when people are selling 33-year-old bottles of wine, it's always good stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
No one ever says, this is Blue Nun 1982. But I wonder how much that would cost.
Yeah.
Could you get it for a tenner?
But you could get it on eBay. You could buy a bottle of 30-year-old whiskey, couldn't you, for a couple hundred quid?
But that's good stuff.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, I just wonder, like, could you cheaply... He wants to buy something cheap, presumably.
He could just go and have a glass of it. He could go to some vintner or whiskatarian who could just give him a glass rather than a full bottle.
True. Anyway, no, he's asking for edible food.
Yeah. Edible food.
So.
None of these inedible foods. Apparently they have found edible honey in ancient Roman tombs that is thousands of years old.
You don't want to go eating in a tomb, though.
No, but you can take it out of the tomb and eat it sitting on the tomb.
Can you? But, I imagine UNESCO have rules about that sort of thing.
But I assume when they do things like where they open up a tomb in Pompeii and they're like, oh, look, we found this fish sauce that's still edible. Mm. They're probably saying technically not toxic.
Wouldn't kill you.
But we wouldn't put it in our mouths.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a cheese. It's possible.
No, I don't think so.
Something like a parmesan.
No, possibly.
The thing is, is that a ham?
Honey is a good one because that's a natural preservative, right? So that can last for a long time. Yeah. People know that that lasts hundreds of years.
Sugar generally is long-lasting. Yeah, okay. That's, sugar is a preservative.
But apart from honey and sugar, okay, is there anything that is natural that could last that long?
What about tinned food, natural tinned
that's
food.
That's it. It's basically got to be a processed food, hasn't it?
What about a pickled onion?
Yeah, but I mean, you've still got processed there. And you could still eat things like ship's biscuits, things that were developed in order not to go off. So
what's a
like,
ship biscuit?
A ship's biscuit wouldn't last for 30 years,
no, apparently,
would it?
Apparently they do. It's like a very dry, rusky biscuit that they had on ships. If you're at sea for years, you needed a lot of provisions when you set off. So for years, you'd just be eating like salted meat and corpses. Bits of rotten
sounds
wood.
Amazing. Didn't the delicatessen / meat shop in the Covered Market in Oxford have a ham which was about 150 years old?
That's so disgusting. That makes my stomach turn.
It looked horrible on the outside, but I guess because it's very salted and cured. On the inside, it was... I guess it must have been edible.
I've heard of a few of these hams, and I think they sometimes take off a little sliver to prove that it is edible. But again, I'm not sure it's nice.
What about spices? I reckon... Because my mum definitely, I know for a fact, her spice rack hasn't been touched since 1999. Mm. There are some there that I reckon probably are 10 years older than that. I know there are none older than that because we had a fire in 1989.
Oh, no.
So then they'd all be smoked.
But, well, that could be nice.
But certainly, I lived at home from 1999 to 2001, and she never touched a spice then, and they're still there.
Yeah, they won't taste good. Because
they're technically edible.
Yeah, after even a few months, your spices just taste of dust if they come pre-ground.
You could do an ancient cinnamon challenge, couldn't you?
Yes.
And it probably wouldn't be that bad, because it wouldn't taste too much.
Maybe one way of doing this, Dave, is to find something that has not been ready as a foodstuff for the duration of your life, but something that is the same age as you that you could kill and eat.
Ah,
like there's some really old lobsters.
Yes, I was just thinking lobsters, the average age of a lobster is about 30, isn't
it? Is it?
I think so. The ones, the big ones you see in a tank in a Chinese restaurant.
Or a really old horse that was going to die anyway.
Oh. That feels really wrong. Killing an animal the same age as you just so you can eat it.
He set the challenge, Martin. It's not our fault that it's wrong.
He's saying minimum of faff, though. So I think the minimum of faff is just find a granny and ask her for...
Oh, what about a jam? What about a jam that's been sealed?
Yes, get some jam off her, or just ask her for some fruitcake or Christmas pudding, because she's probably got a stash going right back to the 1860s.
Actually, again, my grandmother in the freezer does have some cake that I reckon...
Yeah.
I mean, I think the limit's probably 20 years, because every 20 years the freezer goes bang.
Although
but it's
my mum would affect the transfer from one freezer to another. Had they not gone through a period in 2005 to 2007 of moving a lot, there would be things, Dave, that I could sell you for a very reasonable fee.
What about eating sourdough loaf from Boudin's Bakery?
Sourdough.
Boudin Bakery in San Francisco, the famous bakery, claims to have been using the same sourdough starter for their bread since, I think, about 1849.
Yeah, but what does that mean?
That's the thing that makes the bread rise. So
it's the same bacterial colony. I mean, it may have changed a bit over time, but it's the same pool that you're drawing from. So you may be eating a bacterium that was born in 1849, and it's fairly likely to be a bacterium that was born in the 70s.
It's not a bad answer, but it's a bit of a wanker's answer, isn't
it? But it's much nicer.
It's a bit of a strokey bit. What about this weird sourdough thing from San Francisco? Dave wants to know, where can I get a packet of beans that's 33 years old, doesn't he?
You go to a newsagent that's been shut down for a really long time and just rifle through the stuff that's left there.
Actually, I don't watch the soaps, but I reckon if you went to the sets of Corrie or EastEnders, I imagine they have a newsagent there. Mm. I bet some of the goods on the shelves in the newsagents...
Not so good anymore.
They're probably still there, because the ones that are at the back, the packets haven't really changed if they're at the back.
Mm.
They've probably got packets of beans there that have been... And strongly lit as well, so they're probably going to kill you, but they'd be there. They're technically edible.
Dave specified that he's unwilling to die in this exercise. He hasn't, has he?
He did say edible, so I suppose edible does mean not going to kill me.
Just means he can eat it.
I think the best suggestion was, unfortunately, animal that is still alive, you know.
But what about a plant? What if there's a licorice tree you can chop some bark off and chew in the room?
That's not a bad one.
That's a little bit less violent. I love licorice.
But again, is the bark that you're going to be eating then going to be 33 years old?
Well, what an easy-ish solution for this would just be to search eBay for some sweets that were discontinued in the late 70s, early 80s. Yes. Because there'll be some kind of sweet. It won't have gone off because it was so artificial to start with.
Mm.
And it probably won't be that expensive because it's just a 10p sweet. And it will be just as disgusting as when it was fresh.
Yeah, and also if you only have one of it, if you only have one fruit bolo, that's not going to kill you, is it?
Yeah, one Zoom slab or whatever. Yeah. Something that remains forever fresh and delicious, even after all these years, are our classic episodes of Answer Me This, which are available at answermethisstore.com. And we've gone back to early 2009 to episode 87 for today's intermission.
Hi, Helen and Ollie. This is Alan from Glasgow. Answer me this, please. In the film Dirty Dancing, something's always bothered me.
What could it be? That film is watertight.
At the end of Dirty Dancing, the Patrick Swayze character goes up to the girl's family and says, "Nobody puts baby in the corner." This makes no sense to me. The whole film is about baby coming of age and becoming this girl, Frances. Surely it makes more sense for them to come up and say, "Nobody puts Frances in the corner." So answer me this, why did he say nobody puts baby in the corner?
Maybe that's symptomatic that even though she's coming of age, she's finding a paternal figure in Patrick Swayze and she's been infantilised by her new beau.
Or maybe.
Maybe.
More likely.
As we found out, is that he drags her up on the stage.
Yeah, and then he says...
Then he makes a big speech and goes, "I've met someone amazing, she's blah-de-blah-de-blah and blah-de-blah, and her name is Frances Houseman."
And that is the moment where the father stands up as if to say, "Why, you little..."
"You can have sex with her before marriage, but you will not call her by the name we gave her."
But the point is, that dramatic moment would be undercut, wouldn't it, Alan from Scotland?
If he'd said
when he went up to the table, "No one puts Frances in the corner," then he'd have nothing to say on the stage.
And her family probably would be like, "Who?"
Now, remember, listeners, if you want to send us a question using the voice that you have within, then you can call this number.
02081235877.
Or you can Skype Answer Me This, and let's see who has done that.
Hi, my name's Laura from London, and I've recently been watching the TV show Grey's Anatomy, and in it, Meredith's little sister, Lexi, says she has a photographic memory. So, Helen and Ollie, answer me this. Do some people really have photographic memories? And if so, how does it work?
Not a controversy about this, isn't there? Some people say they don't actually exist.
Yes, I didn't realise that the literal meaning of a photographic memory is remembering everything as if it's a photograph that you could zoom in on with accurate detail at any point of your life.
Mm.
Whereas I think the colloquial way to use photographic memory is somebody who can like learn something very, very quickly in a really detailed, exacting way.
There are people like that. But the actual definition, as you say, the literal definition of photographic memory, I did always used to think that that was... possible, but as I say, as far as I can tell, a lot of people say it's actually just not medically possible to do that.
Well, there are people who can photographically remember things because visual learning is often a good way to remember, but being able to recall everything that ever happened to you is such a rare condition that scientists had to coin a name for it a few years ago, which was hyperthymestic syndrome, because they found a woman called Jill Price who could remember every...
It's brilliant when it gets down to the mundane level of an actually ordinary person.
Really boring name.
Ladies and gentlemen, imagine a Victorian
Jill
man
Price.
In the freak show, Jill Price, the woman who remembers everything.
She has written a book called something like The Woman Who Remembers Everything.
Uh-huh.
But the unfortunate Jill Price, she can remember every single thing that has happened since she was 14, and she says it's unbearable.
Imagine if she remembered all of these conversations.
Yeah, well, she says, "I can remember every insult, every embarrassing thing."
Yeah.
She's a widow, so she can probably remember that more than she wants to. She said it's like having a film running in her head all the time, so it's exhausting and she can't sleep properly. So they've been trying to find other people that have this same syndrome, and I think they've found a handful now that they've been studying for years. And the thing that they all have in common is that their brains are a slightly different shape. And so they thought, why are their brains a slightly different shape? And it might be because of trauma. Not necessarily a physical one, but an emotional one. So she might have suffered some kind of emotional trauma at 14 that affected the way her brain is made. Mm. That means she is tortured by being able to remember everything.
But even Jill Price presumably doesn't literally remember, in the sense of a photographic memory, opening a book and taking a sort of laser copy of it so that she'd be able to remember the third word from the third line on the right. It's not that kind of thing.
No, apparently that is the way that Jill Price can remember. So she can not only remember what she was doing every day, but also what was happening on that day. So they've tested her, and she kept a diary for about 20 years. So they could cross-reference that along with what actually happened factually on that day in the news and so on.
Yeah.
But a lot of people can teach themselves to remember a 9,000-page book or something.
Yeah, but there's all kinds of tricks, aren't there, to help further your memory if you're a normal person, if you're not Jill Price.
Yeah.
But That is slightly different, isn't it? That's all the sort of Nintendo brain training stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, and you can't take that to extremes. So I think there was one famous example where they had like 5,000 pieces of paper and the guy said put a pin through it, and then he named the word that the pin went through on each page because he'd memorised the position of all of the words on these pieces of paper.
Such a waste of your brain though, isn't it? Because you think, in a way, yeah, it is amazing, but imagine if you took all the hours that you spent preparing to take part in this fairly abstract and ridiculous challenge and did something useful, like just volunteered in a charity shop. The thing is, though, you're happier if you're stupider generally in life, aren't you? And I think you're probably...
Why are you asking me?
Well, I'm telling you my experience. I find that I'm happier remembering less.
Yes, me too.
On a fundamental level, I'm very sad about it. Like, if I actually think, oh, what was the day like when I was 17? Oh, I can't really remember. That's awful. Like, I hate the fact that there's whole people that I've forgotten about. There are whole books that I've read that I have absolutely no memory of. There are conversations that other people remember me having with them that I have literally no memory of whatsoever. Mm. That's sad. But at the same time, until they remind me that I've forgotten them...
You can't be sad about what you don't know you've lost. I can't remember lots of things now, like today's date, for instance. But I do have... like, my brain is full of ridiculous, stupid little details that I don't need to know and was never particularly interested in. And I'd often wondered why I could remember so exactly things I read in magazines in the mid-90s. But apparently it's because a lot of children have like a very, very good memory, but it fades as soon as you hit adulthood, which is when it might come in handy. So maybe I stored all those things up then.
Well, you know, you've made great use of it in this podcast, haven't
you? Yes, I suppose.
All that useless information, at least you've managed to employ some of this.
Still loads left.
Another 8 years left.
One day I'm going to find the pub quiz of dreams. But it is annoying that I didn't use that super memory time that I didn't know about until I looked into it for this episode to learn 7 different languages.
Well, that's why they say, isn't it, that children should, if they're able to, learn musical instruments and learn languages because it's easier.
But when you're 15, it all starts going.
All starts going, does it? Yeah.
It'd be quite handy, wouldn't it, to have a little SD card slot in your brain that you can download thoughts and memories onto for later dates.
No, but that's what I'm saying. I'm not sure it is handy. I actually think it might be helpful to forget. You know, people say when they go through a really emotionally turbulent time that it's good that things move on, you get better in a way. I think that is partly because you literally forget some of it. I think it is useful to forget some of it. And I think, you know, if you don't have particularly exciting thoughts, at least, you know, repeating yourself doesn't feel frustrating when years later you're still listening to music that is just as unexciting and reading books that are just as uninteresting. You're not at least repeating within yourself the same thought process because you've forgotten you've thought it before.
It's blissful to forget.
Yeah, I'm genuinely.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Remember this.
Yeah.
I agree with you. Here is another question, though, about recording things. It's from Dr. David A. Holmes, MBBS.
Which itself sounds like a memory challenge, trying to remember his title by the end of the show.
What does MBBS mean?
Master of Big Ballsy
Big Bottom Studies.
Big Bottom Studies, that's good.
He says, Ollie, answer me this. In this day and age of amazing computers, etc., why is CCTV so crap at identifying horrible people that commit crime?
Well, you have to question what are CCTV cameras doing.
Yes.
And CCTV cameras actually have a dual function.
Mm-hmm.
Deterrent, number one.
Yes, but then couldn't you just put up a fake CCTV camera that doesn't have any film in it?
Yes, exactly.
Presumably they've not got actual film in anymore, they're electronic.
No, of course they're electronic, yeah. But the point is, deterrent number one,
okay.
And then evidence gatherer number two.
Yes.
So if actually you've got a crime hotspot somewhere and you just want the deterrent, yeah, you could put up a fake one and people do. So, you know, when you say, oh, well, the quality of the film isn't very good, well, obviously, to get the best quality image that you can, you need the best quality lenses.
Which can cope with outside climates and dirt.
Yeah, and then you need to clean them regularly. Mm-hmm. And then you need to position them perfectly.
Yes.
And then you need to store all the footage.
And you need the people doing the crime to stand still.
Yeah. In other words, it becomes more expensive the better quality you want it to be.
Also, is there a problem with the amount of data they're collecting? It can't be the highest quality.
Exactly. So most of the pictures that they are collating are compressed. Mm-hmm. And they take fewer frames per minute than you would if you were filming with a video camera.
Yeah.
Because it is just to give an impression. And it does give an impression.
Yeah.
It does help the police identify, okay, this person was wearing a beige jacket, this person was black or white. It's not supposed to be the high definition image of them because you'd need a super high quality camera in exactly the right location with exactly the right light, and you need to be storing everything.
Yeah.
And it's too expensive. So it's the compromise between deterrent and evidence, basically. My dad owns his own business and has CCTV because his business involves selling expensive things.
Yes.
And he has that thing where there's now an app, so you can look at it when you're not in the office.
Is your dad now Billy Baldwin in Sliver?
He's constantly, constantly checking it. I mean, I...
You would, wouldn't you?
So, well, you
it's
would...
Like, it's like the early days of Big Brother when you could just watch the live stream all the time.
Exactly, but it's nothing in there is as entertaining as Jade Goody. Most of the time, you can't really see what's going on because he's got a car showroom.
Yeah.
He's got his five employees in the cars. He can see on his mobile phone on a beach in Turkey the shadow of a car and a man polishing it. You can't see what they're saying. You can't really see who they're talking to. You can just... I guess he can check that his employees have turned up for work that day.
But is your dad technologically canny enough to be sure that the employees haven't just filmed themselves on a loop polishing a car and then they've somehow managed to jimmy the system so that is playing and they can just piss off for 5 days while your dad's in Turkey?
Like Kevin McAllister would do if he grew up to become an employee of my dad.
Absolutely.
No, he's not. He would be fooled by that.
Yeah.
That would be complex, though, in a little bit, I think, beyond his staff, who are very technical people in the field of cars.
Yes.
And car mechanics, probably not so into jimmying CCTV systems.
Well, then he's lucky, isn't he?
But it is addictive. And I wonder whether... Because when I was a child, if you had this as well, when I was about 12, 13, one of the many fantasies I had about being a grown-up would be that I would be the guy in Sliver, basically. That I would... I don't know why I had this fantasy, but I always imagined when I was rich enough to have my own house, one of the things I would have, apart from my own postal book so I could get pornography, would be I'd have mirrored walls... Whole mirrored walls in, like, guest bedrooms. And it wasn't just about perving on people whilst they were getting changed, although obviously that was part of it. It was so that I could then just go and listen to people's conversations behind closed doors.
But then why would you need mirrors for that?
Yeah, but it wasn't cameras. It was me standing behind the mirror listening.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't know I was there.
But also looking, presumably. Because if it was just a wall
that
looked like a wall, you could still listen.
I could still
listen. You couldn't see, whereas you want the two-way mirror thing.
Whereas, of course, they'd be very aware because the house would be full of mirrors.
So how have you done up the guest room in your new house?
Just mirrors, floor to ceiling. We like it.
That's not a recording device in the potpourri. Nuh-uh. Does Dr. David A. Holmes' MBBS mean why is it that they can't do that thing like they used to on X-Files where they were like, here's a piece of grainy footage,
just zoom
in,
that in for me.
Zoom in, crystal clear,
yeah.
Enhanced.
HD.
Yeah, that's a fake tooth. That's the first clue back to the gold merchant we met last week.
Zoom in on that barcode on that thing he's holding. No, that's a number 8, not a B. Duh.
You're right, you never once, not even just to balance it so it seemed more convincing when that did happen, ever saw the scene where they were like, zoom in, zoom in, zoom in. Oh,
so
I can't
pixelated.
See him. He's
so
blurry.
Yeah.
Oh, what's that? Yeah, that's the same bloke, but it's just too blurry. Quality's bad. Never happens once.
Have you got the footage? No, we
lost
over
it.
The match was on.
Hello, this is Joseph Katz. Helen and Ollie, answer me this. What is the average speed of an escalator?
Escalators, as they're produced now, go anywhere between 90 and 180 foot per minute. That's the range.
Right, okay, some of them feel like they're going a lot slower.
Yeah, well, some of them are designed to go slowly because they have a different purpose. For example, in a department store, the purpose is that whilst you're going up, you're looking around at the garments and merchandise, thinking, oh, I'll go to level 2 and try that on.
That's why it takes so long to get to the toilet.
Well, it takes
long,
yes. Of course, the point about escalators is that they are slower than elevators, but they can carry more people. You can get 10,000 people per hour on an average escalator. I'm pausing because I keep wanting to say elevator when I'm saying escalator and vice versa.
It's not like there was an Aerosmith song, Love in an Escalator.
It should have been.
As we're going down.
Should have been, because they could have had love with 10,000 people instead of just a few.
I reckon you could do that on the really long escalator in Angel Station, you know, the one that's like the longest in Europe.
Well, St. Petersburg Underground would be the best place, 949 feet there.
Wow!
Not just love, but a whole marriage on an escalator there.
How long would that take? I was going to say 180 feet per minute. So that's almost 5 minutes.
You well, could I'm not sure that is the fastest. So they go as fast as 180 foot. I don't know how fast that one goes. Your average escalator is set to go at 145 foot per minute.
But is it possible for, say, a station to speed up an escalator a bit at rush hour to get more people going through?
I don't think so, no. I mean, possible technologically, yes, but I don't think the station controller has that command.
My mum used to be afraid of escalators. She wouldn't travel on escalators.
Well, people did fall down them.
I think she fell down on one when she was pregnant with me and she wouldn't do it.
That explains so much.
Also, you can get stuck in them. I remember seeing
a
lot...
How do you get stuck in one?
Well, I remember seeing a lot more warning videos and things when I was young.
You get clothing trapped.
Yeah, clothing trapped. If you stand too close to the side, your foot would get sucked in. Don't see that much anymore.
Not so much anymore.
People are obviously savvy.
In India, they have sari guards on the escalator.
Very smart, because you don't want to be caught with an unravelling sari.
Nope. In places like Hamleys, they've got those kind of plastic guards. As you go up into the ceiling, so you don't put your arm up and get your arm chopped off.
Because too many people in Hamleys are looking for a way out of this life.
Hello. I'm Wilson, the ball from Castaway, and here is my song about my favourite balls. Football, rugby ball, volleyball ball, tennis ball, Zoe ball, basketball, netball, handball, debutante ball, bowling ball, baseball, big sweaty ball.
Answer Me This Sports Day, a marathon of fun and games, out now at answermethispodcast.com/albums.
Here's a question from Lizzie from Sydney in Australia, who says, I have been accepted into animal and veterinary bioscience at the University of Sydney, and I'm very excited to commence next year because this will allow me to transfer to veterinary science later and then enter my ultimate dream career.
Opera singer.
And be a veterinary surgeon.
Oh.
There is one slight problem. And when she says slight, she actually means extremely significant, massive problem.
She hates animals.
I am allergic to certain kinds of animals and animal hair or fur.
Mm.
The type varies so much that I can't pin down exactly what sets my allergies off. For example, in December 2014, I went away for a month, and when I got back, I was allergic to my own cat.
What?
Which
That's hell.
Which may not be that weird, because I was initially allergic to her when she adopted us, but I also became allergic to my best friend's cat, who has a very different kind of hair to my cat. I never had a problem with being allergic to them before I went on this trip, which makes it even weirder. I've had this problem all my life with the allergies just sort of coming and going with no obvious kind of pattern. E.g., I didn't grow out of my allergies, nor does being exposed to the triggering animal for a long time seem to help, nor am I allergic to just a specific species or type of animal.
You know when sometimes people get into psychotherapy because they themselves have mental health issues?
Yeah.
I do wonder whether Lizzie is only studying veterinary science to try and work out what her own allergies are.
Well, she's really become an allergy specialist then, of humans. When I did work experience at a vet, I must admit that I was kind of almost dying and had to pretend that I had a cold to excuse my red eyes using an inhaler and runny nose. Luckily, they didn't notice my blotchy skin.
You would have thought that the whole point of work experience would be to try the job and see whether it's suitable for you.
Indeed.
You know, that is really what is in it for you from the work experience.
I mean, the ideal thing about work experience is that it is not near fatal.
Yes, it flags up crucial operational issues. You know, you want to be a truck driver, do you have arms? That kind of thing.
Well, Lizzie says, generic hay fever and allergy medication works very well, but I'm terrified that when I become a vet, I will have to use it for the rest of my life, thus wasting a lot of money on medication, or I would become immune to the effects of the medication because of the continual use. Yes, that can happen, but I would argue that the medication isn't a waste because you would be earning a lot more as a vet than you would spend on generic medication.
Mm.
I'm scared of actually asking or telling anyone in the profession or anyone I know about this because I really don't want them to think I'm incapable of achieving this feat. It's a hard and very long course. I don't want people to think I'm an idiot for going into a rather ironic field of work either, or waste my 9 years studying to discover I really cannot function around animals on a day-to-day basis.
Particularly if you knew it right from the beginning.
Indeed. But she's been accepted, so she's already on the path to doom.
Well, it's as if the next 9 years have already happened.
So, Ollie, answer me this. Am I an idiot for pursuing such a career given my allergies? I've always known what I wanted to do with my life and do not envy most of my arty friends who don't. That's not just an arty thing, I think, not knowing what you want to do. That's almost everybody I know in every species of pursuit.
That's true, but it's also true to say that a lot of the people who drift towards the arts are the people who haven't got a clue what they want to do.
Yeah, well, it's easier, isn't it?
Yeah.
So not being able to do this would probably send me into a perpetual existential crisis. Help! What should I do?
Whew. Well, as Helen pointed out, you're framing the use of medication for the rest of your career as something which is thousands of dollars wasted. I do think that is something you're just going to have to accept.
Has she not been to a doctor? They're not going to rat on her to her future veterinary employers. Lizzie, if you haven't been to a doctor and if you haven't been to an allergy specialist, go now, because there might be something really obvious that they know about and you don't, or they might be able to prescribe a specific antihistamine that would make things so much better.
Yeah, but actually, I know that at Cambridge University, scientists there are actually already working on an inhaler for animal allergens. And they're 2 years into a 5-year process, according to the article I read in 2013.
Okay, so it'll be well finished by the time she needs it.
Could be commercially available.
Also, you can do courses of allergy shots, which are meant to cure you within 5 years, but it does mean getting jabs every week.
But in any case, my point being, even if for the rest of your life you have to spend thousands of dollars on medication. As you say, you want to get into veterinary medicine because you're passionate about it. You like working with animals. It's what you've always wanted to do.
It's hard to find something you really want to do.
It's not just for the money.
No.
As it happens, that is a job that if you do well, you're going to earn a lot of money anyway. So actually, you know, you're going to be earning enough that you'll be able to pay for the medicine. And, you know, other people have to migrate to different continents to get the job that they want.
Yeah.
Other people have to get up at 3 a.m. You know, some people have to send all their money to a kid they never see. Your thing is, you're going to have to spend a portion of your income on anti-allergen material.
Or, in the course of her 9-year study, she might find a particular area or specialism that actually works for her. Like, if she got really interested in reptilian pets or fish.
Is there a career in being a reptilian vet?
In Australia.
In Sydney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've got lots of novelty reptiles. Tortoise vet.
Also.
Jellyfish vet.
I do think, although she does say as well, that, you know, you can't say continued exposure will make it get better or anything like that. The only case she gave us, going away from her cat for a month, then returning to her cat and being allergic to her own cat when she wasn't before, does suggest to me that actually, in some cases, continued exposure has nullified the reaction she was getting.
Yeah, well, she said her allergies come and go, but I suppose it's a bit of a gamble for her.
Point is, if she's a full-time vet, even if she spends 6 months in pain, actually maybe eventually her body will find a way of resisting the constant fur.
I suppose you just can't guarantee it. She wouldn't be the only vet who is allergic to animals.
No, there are
quite a lot, and they say it is hard, and you just make sure you take the meds when you're entering into a bad patch and keep your hands really clean, because if you don't have too much of the animal on your skin, then it's a bit better.
But also, I know, like, you know, there are a lot of cat lovers who are allergic to cats. And the advice to those people is, well, if you want to have a cat, what you do is you have a bedroom at home, which is
cat-free,
which is your bedroom, which is cat-free. It's not the cat's bedroom. However much you like the idea of a cat on your bed and you go to sleep purring, doesn't come in. And not only is it cat-free, it is completely pet-free.
I like the way you said Coco there.
It's completely Coco-free. You remove carpets, you remove wall hangings, you remove anything that attracts dust. You make it the most sort of allergen-pure room in the house.
So it's a bit like you're sleeping in an MRI scanner.
Exactly. You don't have any... You have anti-allergenic bed linen, and you don't have, you know, duck feathers and all the rest of it. And so the idea being...
8 hours a day, at least.
Exactly. A third of your life, you're not around pet fur.
Very smart.
So I would extrapolate further and say, if you're around animals all day, then unfortunately you probably shouldn't have pets at home.
Yeah.
You might have to make that decision.
Yeah. Except for reptile tortoise pets.
Except for
jellyfish. If she's not willing to sacrifice her dream career for her health, then that's a price worth paying, I think, not having the pets at home.
Yes, exactly. Not having pets at home. Actually, maybe even when you go out wearing one of those weird masks, so that you as much as possible, you are limiting your exposure the rest of the time, then you can probably handle being at work for 10 hours a day, being around animals, as long as you're careful.
I think this is a very difficult decision to make, actually, because for a lot of my adult life, I've been in the wilderness career-wise, not sure what I want to do. And
imagine
really,
if you became allergic to microphones, Helen.
I know. If I hadn't found podcasting as a career, there could have been another 50 years of this wilderness wandering. Therefore, I always think people who know what they want to do are really, really lucky.
Mm.
And it would be such a shame for her not to be able to do it. But I do think it would be rather dangerous for her to perform surgery on animals if she is sneezing and her eyes are swollen shut. So please be sensible, Lizzie.
I think that's right. But as you say, there are other vets in this situation.
Yes.
I wouldn't be at all surprised if once you get to veterinary school, you meet other people that are allergic to animals too.
Yeah, but she says she doesn't want to ask anybody. But why can't you ask people that are not connected to you? So people in different countries who work as vets. You can just email people. In fact, there are probably vets doing podcasts. There are probably vets doing podcasts where they answer people's vet problems. You should give them a call.
Yeah, allergen me this, that's what you need to find.
Sick puppies, that's what it's probably called. Well, that's the end of Answer Me This, episode 313. Deal with it.
But there'll be more in the next episode of Answer Me This. Won't be more now. That really is it.
Well, there's like 2 minutes of more.
Yeah.
That's just this business.
That's just this is faff. We're just wrapping up, really.
We just can't bear to say goodbye. We're keeping you hanging on a little bit more.
Never can say goodbye.
What we mean today is please send us your questions for future episodes. And our contact details are on our website.
AnswerMeThisPodcast.com, where you can also find links to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. And also, if you want to buy our albums and apps and things, remember to go to AnswerMeThisStore.com.
And if you do buy any of those things, then you're helping support the show and keeping it going.
Please do.
Thank you.
And please return in 2 weeks' time.
Bye.